This podcast is brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short. You can find more podcasts and other resources on our website, www.acamh.org, and follow us on social media by searching ACAMH.
Welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on iTunes or your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. Today I'm interviewing Sam Cortese, Professor of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at the University of Southampton, and Associate Editor of the journal CAM. In 2019, Sam was awarded the Kramer-Polnow Prize for Excellence in Biological Research in Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. Sam, thanks for joining me. Can you start by saying a little bit about yourself by way of an introduction?
Thank you. Hi, Joe and everyone, and thanks for having me. So yeah, as you said, I'm currently a professor of child and adolescent psychiatry at the University of Southampton, and also a honorary consultant, child adolescent psychiatrist for a Solent NHS Trust. And in terms of my background, I completed my medical degree at the University of Verona in Italy, where I was also trained in child and adolescent neuropsychiatry. So actually in Italy, there is the training is slightly different. There is a combined training combining pediatric neurology and child and adolescent psychiatry. And then after this, I moved to Paris in France, where I worked as basically the equivalent of what is here a clinical lecturer. So doing clinical activity, but also research and teaching. And then I briefly worked almost 1 year as a consultant in Tours, another city in France. And following this, I was awarded a fellowship by the European Agency, one of those fellowships which are called Marie Curie, which allowed me to spend a couple of years as a postdoc fellow in New York, being trained in neuroimaging applied to child psychiatry, and then also to spend 1 year back to Europe in Italy. And then for a number of personal and professional reasons, I moved actually to the UK in 2013, where I first worked as a locum consultant in Cambridgeshire and Peterborough Foundation Trust. And then I got a position as associate professor and honorary consultant in Southampton. And finally, I was promoted last year to full professor. So yeah, that's my trajectory, which, as you can see, probably, you know, I think I moved quite a lot, probably more than the average of my colleagues. But, you know, looking at other colleagues, is not so infrequent. We all tend to move quite a lot because this is the nature of our work. And, you know, working as a researcher implies, you know, networks and being in touch with different institutions.
Right. Yeah, it sounds like a very international career that you've had so far. Sam, your research aims to inform clinical decision making in child and adolescent psychiatry with a specific focus on ADHD. How did this come to be an area of interest for you?
Yeah, so it's interesting, you know, looking back, I think, I think your question can be split into, so why the topic of research, which is clinical decision making in child and adolescent psychiatry, and why the specific focus on ADHD? So in relation to the first point, I would say that as a clinician, of course, I was always interested in being able to treat in the best possible way the patients. And I have to say, I was quite annoyed sometimes when I used to see a number of colleagues, also including my mentor supervisors, adopting some strategies, intervention strategies, which were not really up to date based on evidence. It was more on tradition and, you know, we do like this here. So, you know, you need to do the same. I was very keen to, become proficient in intervention and knowledgeable in interventions which are really supported by the best available evidence. And in terms of ADHD, I think that, at the beginning, I didn't have any specific focus on any specific disorder. Probably, I think one of the reasons why I became particularly interested in ADHD was the fact that it is a disorder for which we have probably the most efficacious, at least in the short term, medications, pharmacological treatment. So the effect of this medication can be quite spectacular. And when we look at the evidence base and, you know, what the number in terms of effect size tell us about the effect of this medication, clearly they are quite, they're in a way better than other medications we use in psychiatry. So I was kind of fascinated and intrigued by the effect of these medications. So I probably, this is one of the reasons, and because I had the feeling that we can do something quite quickly and quite in an important way.
Thank you. Your work involves meta-analytical approaches and evidence synthesis. Why are systematic reviews and methods of this sort so important when it comes to child and adolescent mental health research?
Sure. So I would say they are important, of course, across medicine in general, in psychiatry, but particularly probably in child and adolescent mental health research and also clinical practice, because for quite a long time, the field has lagged behind in terms of implementing a rigorous methodology. So when I speak with some colleagues, I often hear, sentences like this treatment is evidence-based, is supported by evidence. But when it comes to looking at the real quality of this evidence, it can be very different across different interventions. So I think that in general, everybody is talking about evidence-based treatment, but then we don't really know what this means. So I think that, evidence synthesis is at the highest level in terms of informing clinical practice, because it does not rely just on one individual study. Rather, it takes into consideration all the body of research. And of course, it's just one of the elements that we need to take into account in decision making. Other elements, of course, are the preferences of the patients and their family and the particular circumstances. So, people oftentimes think that a meta-analysis provides the absolute and ultimate truth to a decision-making. This is not absolutely true. It is an element, but, an intervention which may be supported by high level of evidence in general may not be the preferred intervention for a specific patient. So I think we need to strike a balance between, using the evidence, but also using our clinical sense, and the human relationship with the patient should not be forgotten, of course.
Yeah, no, it's hugely important. Sam, you work for the European ADHD Guidelines Group. What's your role within this group?
Sure. So, first of all, the European ADHD Guidelines Group is a working group of another larger network, which is called UNITAIDIS. It's a complex name. It stands for European Network of Hyperkinetic Disorders. And it's a working group made by clinicians and or researchers. We work for free. We are not paid to do this. So it's mostly, our spare time, evening, weekends, and so on and so forth. And our really goal, our remit is really to first appraise the evidence via reviews, systematic reviews of the literature, meta-analysis, as I said, and then translate these, use these to support clinical recommendations in terms of management of ADHD or related conditions. So I'm one of the members, and during the years I started working for the European ADHD Guidelines Group, or EAGG, in 2010, I think. Over the years, I've taken the lead on a number of projects of the group, in particular appraising the evidence in terms of the efficacy of cognitive training, neurofeedback for ADHD, and more recently medication. So with a large work on which aimed to compare the efficacy and tolerability of different medications for ADHD. And this has been, I guess, quite important work because it has informed guidelines group around the world, still informing. And I think it's important to highlight, however, that even though the name actually of the group says guidelines, we don't really produce guidelines, such as, for instance, the NICE. Everybody is familiar with the NICE guidelines. So our job in a way is quite different. So we try to provide recommendations which are usually not covered by these general guidelines such as the NICE guidelines, or more specific aspects that are important in the clinical practice. So we are not really a guideline group, because the process of guidelines include is a very complex one. It includes analysis of cost effectiveness of the treatment, includes stakeholders and patients' opinion. So we don't do this, but we try really to provide guidance on clinically relevant topics.
Mm-hmm. And I understand you've recently produced guidance for the European Group on ADHD management during the COVID-19 pandemic. Are you able to share some of the key recommendations from that?
Sure. So as you said, yes, we published this quite recently, a couple of months ago, and really the rationale for that was to try to support our colleagues in decision making during these challenging and unprecedented times. And I guess the main reason why we did this was that a number of colleagues were uncertain as to whether they should or they had to continue or start an assessment for ADHD or how to treat these patients in terms of pharmacological and especially non-pharmacological treatment. So a number of colleagues were really uncertain, and our concern was that due to this particular restriction due to COVID pandemic, a number of clinicians were not able to implement an effective treatment for these patients. So we thought that not treating these patients in a way was more risky than treating them, given the concerns of the COVID pandemic in terms of exposure to the patient. So we produced actually two guidance. The first one, which is the main one, and then a second one, which is more specific for the pharmacological treatment. And I guess that the main point is that despite the current restriction, it is possible to assess and to manage remotely, in most cases, patients and the families with ADHD. So the guidelines actually include some tips in terms of how to support with behavioral strategies children and adolescents and their families who are struggling. And these tips were originally built on previous work conducted by our group and other groups in terms of behavioral treatment for ADHD. And then one of the group members, Professor Edmund Sonuga-Bark, went on developing further these tips into a comprehensive resource, which is known as Families Under Pressure. and it's free for parents. And the second part of the recommendation was around the pharmacological treatment. And the main point that we made was that it is possible under certain circumstances to assess remotely and to start a pharmacologic treatment without a face-to-face contact, providing that the baseline assessment is done by other colleagues or by the family themselves in terms of measuring blood pressure, height and weight, and all the parameters which are necessary. So I think that we are receiving some preliminary feedback on this work, and I think that we were pleased to hear that it has been considered a useful tool. And after all, I think it has confirmed what a number of clinicians were already doing, but they felt reassured in knowing that a kind of official body, as the European ADHD Guidelines Group, recommended what they were already implementing in a way in their clinics.
Right. And if somebody's listening to this podcast and they want to access those resources, is there a website they can go to?
Sure. So an important point, we wanted to publish this as an open access document. And unfortunately, when we as academics publish our papers, most of the time the access is not open. So you need to pay. Mm-hmm. And this means that a number of colleagues, especially those who don't have academic affiliations, are not able to access these papers. Yeah. We thought that this was not good at all because we wanted this to be quickly available to the community and in an easy way. So we were lucky to publish these two documents, the main one and the addendum, in a journal which is the Lancet Child and Adolescent Mental Health, which is part of the Lancet family of journals. And the Lancet family of journals are publishing as for free open access all the COVID-19 related papers. So it's enough to just to Google ADHD management, COVID-19, Lancet, and the document will be available for free in internet.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you. While we're on the topic of COVID, you're also a lead researcher for the Collaborative Outcomes Study on Health and Functioning During Infection Times, the COFIT study. This is the largest study into the mental and physical impact of COVID-19 on communities around the world. Can you tell us a bit more about this important study?
Yes, thank you. So, I'm lucky to be involved in this very large study, which is led by two colleagues. So one in the United States and Germany, actually works both in the United States and Germany, which is quite challenging, with Professor Christoph Correll, who is an adult and also child adolescent psychiatrist. And the second colleague, who is the second PI in the study, is Dr. Marco Solmi from the University of Padua, Italy, so quite close to my hometown, Verona. And so this is a large survey which includes more than 250 collaborators across the world and is across more than 100 countries. And it is addressed both to adults, but also to children, adolescents and children aged 6 or more. And I am coordinating the section for the UK. And so the main purpose of this larger survey is to understand, to better understand how people are coping during these challenging times. So, and to find possible risk, but also protective factors for mental and physical well-being. And so I think that the survey in general is It takes around 30 minutes to be completed, and the version for children is simple and it takes around 15 minutes. And the purpose is really to understand, there is quite a long questionnaire which covers basically all the aspects of psychopathology, but also social well-being. And the ultimate goal is really to inform guidelines and future policy and maker practices in terms of really understanding how to strengthen the risk, the protective factors, and to address the risk factors, and to inform ultimately preventive strategies should another pandemic occur in the future.
Right. And what's the timescale on that study? When will there be some sort of results?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. Actually, we plan three waves. So one wave during the pandemic, then a second wave after 6 months after the WHO declares the end of the pandemic, and another wave 12 months after the WHO declares the end of the pandemic, because we want to know also what's going to happen after the pandemic. In terms of specific timeline, it's quite tricky because actually we don't know exactly what's going to happen. And it's possible that the situation may vary across countries. And so another advantage of conducting the same survey across countries is that we have the same questions, so we will be able to also understand to which extent different ways coping with the pandemic in terms of governmental decisions and restrictions have influenced in a way the outcome. So that I guess that the main advantage, because I guess everybody has seen a lot of surveys in these days, these weeks. But I guess the unique aspect of this survey is really that it includes a large number of countries which make possible this comparison. Also, some individuals who may not be comfortable with the English language may access the translated version of COFIT in their native language from other countries. And it is an anonymous survey, and it is easily accessible by internet. So we think that it will generate a number of important data. So far, 60,000 people have completed the survey. Unfortunately, less than 800 from the UK. So we really need to do more. The reason is also because due to a delay with the ethic committee, we started a little bit later compared to other countries. But I would want really everybody to complete this questionnaire. It is not addressed to any particular subgroup of the population. It's open to everyone. But we are, of course, particularly interested in vulnerable subgroups like children, young people, individuals with mental or physical conditions, but it is open to everybody.
Mm. And to access that, could one just Google COFIT? Oh,
sure. It's www.cofit.com with a hyphen between after the H, COFIT. Yeah.
Yeah, COH hyphen FIT. Great. Sam, what else are you currently researching that excites you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that a particular topic of interest now is really the relationship between mental and physical health conditions, not only then ADHD, but across a number of disorders. And the reason I think why I'm quite excited about this is because I think that from the scientific point of view, understanding the links between mental and somatic or physical conditions may allow us to better understand the causes and the pathophysiology and of mental conditions. And also, from a clinical point of view, I think that it doesn't really make sense to split these two aspects. I think that sometimes as psychiatrists, we tend to focus just on the mental aspects. Mm-hmm. Just we look just our patients, just, you know, the brain and the mind. Sure. But there are really important connections between mental and somatic aspects. And a comprehensive management may be really needed. I'm thinking, for instance, when I started with this topic, I was particularly interested, for instance, on the relationship between ADHD and obesity, which was a relationship that seemed quite odd at the beginning, because if anything, people thought, well, actually, these children move a lot. So, you know, they should be thin rather than overweight. It turns out that when we look at the average weight and the prevalence of obesity in individuals with ADHD, this is higher than the average than individuals without ADHD. This does not mean, of course, that everybody with ADHD is overweight, but it means that if you have ADHD, you are more likely to be or become to present with overweight or obesity. And this is very important for the management of these individuals, because, for instance, it has been shown that if you treat ADHD in individuals with obesity, where ADHD had never been diagnosed, if you treat it correctly, this may have also a positive impact on weight reduction. So it's really important to improve the global outcome of the individual. And then from there, I moved to other disorders, and now I'm leading a larger scale project, which really aims to understand better the connection between a large number of mental conditions and a large number of somatic or physical conditions. And I think that this will be informative for future research, but also in terms of clinical practice.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating area, isn't it? Sam, you've got many hats, but one of them is you are the associate editor of CAM. The journal recently celebrated its 25th birthday. I'm just wondering what the highlights have been for you so far in that particular role.
So I was very pleased when I was contacted. It was in 2018 by the chief editor to act as an associate editor for the journal, with a specific focus on the area of systematic reviews and meta-analysis. So basically, I manage the papers, the systematic review and meta-analysis that are submitted to the journal. And I think that it is fair to state that since then, CAM has strengthened the methodological rigor and the quality of the papers accepted for publication. In relation more specifically, I think, to the section systematic reviews and meta-analysis, I think we have introduced more rigorous requirements so that we ask authors to adhere to the recommendations for the conduct and reporting of high quality systematic reviews and meta-analysis in the field. So I think we contribute to really increase the rigor, the methodological rigor of the journal.
All right. And CAM is lauded for helping practitioners convert evidence into practice. So what makes it so successful at this?
Yeah, I think it's really a balance, I would say, between, as I said, methodological rigor, but also, you know, a clinical focus. So CAM is a journal which really speaks the language, I think, of practitioners. The problem, I think, and, you know, I'm on the editorial board of other journals, and I spend quite a lot of time reading papers from different journals. I think that nowadays there are studies which are so complex, based on such a complex methodology, that sometimes clinicians who don't have a particular academic or research angle struggle understanding really what does this paper mean and what the findings were. I think that CAM is unique in that because, yes, as I mentioned, it speaks the language of clinicians, quite clinical friendly, but at the same time is based on a strong evidence-based focus and methodological rigor. And so I think is one of the ideal resources for busy clinicians, because, of course, nowadays everybody is very busy. And so they need something which they need to make choices. And I think that CAM is really a fundamental resource for everybody working in the field of child and adolescent mental health.
Sam, in an age where so much unregulated material can be accessed, what more can be done to promote evidence-based science, in your view?
Well, I think that first, of course, it's important to continue implementing and supporting journals like CAM, who really provide a balance between methodological rigor and evidence base. But probably this is not enough to reach a large number of colleagues. And so I think it's also important to do what ACAM as association is doing, so to provide digest and summaries and interviews of on this content, and to make this content available for free when possible, because one of the main problems is really the access to these resources. Academics have the luxury, so to speak, that they're able to access because they can rely on, accounts paid by their libraries of their universities. Mm-hmm. But a number of clinicians don't have this chance. So I guess it's really important to provide additional alternative ways of accessing, and not only the standard, the usual paper. So podcasts like this, webinars, these are really important resources. And actually, I mean, I got to know the first podcast where I got to know about you. Actually, I remember I was listening in my car going to work, because I live in Winchester and I work in Southampton, which is roughly 20-25 minutes by car. And I thought that, it's good to make a good use of this time in my daily life. And so I think I started listening to podcasts during my trip to work. And so I think that this is really important. And of course, these tools can also be implemented in a more formal way, such as CPD groups, CPD discussions. So I think that we are really looking forward to a different way of acquiring knowledge.
And especially good for people when they're, as you say, are sort of time-strapped, really.
Indeed.
Yeah. Sam, what else is in the pipeline for you that you'd like to mention?
Well, when thinking of the future, I think that what really I'm interested in is anything which is around a prediction. Arguably, what the most important thing as researchers and clinicians we want to know is not about the past, is about the future. So if I treat a patient, will the patient respond to this treatment? And if I see a patient now, how will this patient be in 5 years' time? So I think the science of prediction is very interesting and is being implemented in psychiatry and hopefully progressively more also in child and adolescent psychiatry and psychopathology. And in fact, when I think back on my research so far, as we mentioned earlier, we published quite a lot of meta-analysis, so that evidence synthesis of, what is the state of the art of our knowledge on, for instance, the efficacy or tolerability of treatments. The problem with this quite standard approach is that this provides results which are true at the group level. So in other terms, when we say, in this meta-analysis, we found, for instance, that methylphenidate was the most efficacious or the best tolerated medication in children, or amphetamines were the most efficacious in children in ADHD. This is true at the group level. So these are averages. But when I see a patient, I don't see a group level patient. I see an individual patient with their own specificities. So we can use a quite advanced meta-analytic and evidence synthesis method to get insight on efficacy, effectiveness, tolerability of medication at the individual level. And so this will entail a lot of work and collecting large data sets, and will also entail a change in mindset in how we do research, much more based on sharing data, because we cannot do this just based on one single data set from a lab. We really need to access large data sets. But I think that this should be the goal, and I think probably would be the main goal of my future activity for the next year, because we really need to provide the best treatment on the individual level. This is what we call precision psychiatry, basically.
Mm. Thank you. Finally, Sam, what is your takeaway message for those listening to our conversation?
Well, I think that if they were able to listen in, this is already a good start, because actually, as I said, I'm a clinician myself, and I know how busy clinicians are, how under pressure they are. But I would say that despite this, everybody should really find the time to stay abreast and to update their knowledge in the main areas in terms of child, adolescent, mental health. So I would say that we should really find the time to look at the best evidence, and a good way is really to look at evidence synthesis of papers, which really provides a comprehensive overview and do have a link to the clinical practice. Unfortunately, there are a lot of papers that seems more a theoretical exercise out there rather than really a tool which is really helpful for practitioners. But thanks to the work of journals like CAM or association like ACAM, clinicians are really able to access the best evidence in a relatively short period of time, and to inform their clinical practice. So this will be my first take-home message. The second one, I think that as a clinical academic, my role is to really to bridge the gaps between the academic and the clinical world. And it looks like the action always starts from academics. So academics want to know what clinician thinks. But I would say that clinicians ought to be more proactive in highlighting what they think are the main research priorities, because this will be extremely helpful to academics. So we really need to bridge these gaps, and everybody needs to play a crucial role in this process.
Brilliant. Sam, thank you so much. Great to speak to you. For more details on Professor Sam Cortezar, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H.
This podcast was brought to you by the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, ACAM for short.